Welcome back to part two of the 9/11 special with special guest Professor James H. Fitzer of scholarsfor911truth.org. When we ended part one, we asked Jim to lay out the USG scenario, in other words, the narrative that is put out by the United States government about what happened on 9/11. Now, it seems to me that on the face of it, it's fiction. Yet, I must admit, the world at large, for the most part, bought into it completely. So let's pick it back up with the United States government version, 19 Arab Muslim hijackers who were supposed to be dedicated to their religion against Western Christianity, that they would give their lives that morning, September 11, 2001, for the greater cause. But wait, didn't the ringleader, Muhammad Atta, and his group spend the night before 9/11 drinking and going to strip clubs? No, not in Boston, where the two planes that hit the Twin Towers took off from the next morning, but they were all the way down in Florida that night. In fact, many witnesses saw them, and there's a business card from Atta in the fishbowl of the bar at the strip club. Many say they were boasting loudly about what they were going to do the next morning. So, as you can see, the mystery continues. In the first place, how did Atta and his group get all the way up to Maine early the next morning to fly into Boston to get on that plane before 8 o'clock so they could do the hijacking? And if they took a red eye from Florida to Boston, where is their name on the manifest? And secondly, why bother to go to Maine? They were already past airport security, weren't they? Another thing that's hard to swallow from the U.S. government version is that all 19 Muslims were able to walk past security checks unchallenged and take over the airplanes and turn them into unarmed missiles, armed with nothing except box-cutter knives. Let's bring Jim Fitzer back on. You know, Jim, the part of this whole story that for me is hard to swallow, and all 19 of these men were known to the United States government already and were suspected of being terrorists or wanting to be terrorists, yet they got on these airplanes unchallenged. And then, 48 hours from the incident, we had their names and their pictures on television. Yet, we couldn't stop it from happening in the first place, even though we figured out who they were really fast. Anyway, James, welcome back to the show. Now, there was a 9/11 commission. It had a big budget, and it had, you know, the authority to investigate 9/11. Surely they knew all of the things that we've been talking about here on the program.
Here's what happened there. Henry Kissinger was initially proposed to be the executive director, but Kissinger is great if you want to conceal truth, not reveal it. Instead, the fellow who assumed that position was named Philip Zelikow, who is reported to have run 11 of the 12 committees of the commission with an iron fist. Now, Zelikow was a former insider from the Bush administration. He had had the responsibility of overseeing the transfer of the national security apparatus from Clinton to Bush. He'd co-authored a book with Condoleezza Rice. And get this, you're not going to believe what I tell you now either, Jerry. He's an expert, not in history or in science, but in the creation and manipulation of public myths, of myths that are created to manipulate the public. And that's exactly what he gave us on 9/11.
Okay, so they can control a commission. I think we all agree with that. But let's talk about the photos. I mean, we all saw the planes go into the Twin Towers, or wait a minute. I guess from what we've already discovered here, we really only saw that one video of the first crash, and that didn't happen surfacing until the second day. I mean, even the Pentagon crash is pretty questionable. I think the FBI came along and seized all of the surveillance tapes. Well, okay, maybe we didn't see what we thought we saw after all.
This is one of the most controversial areas of research in 9/11, Jerry. But it looks like we were being subjected to video fakery, that they were using real images of the buildings and then imposing on them images of the planes. This is the best we've been able to produce. They were able to do that in very close to real time. so that persons who watched television thought they were seeing the real deal. There were persons present who said they saw no plane when the explosion occurred. You even get this in some television reports. All of a sudden there's an explosion, and the reporters say, well, I didn't see any plane. It's very, very curious. There's an awful lot of false memory syndrome out there about people who think they saw the planes hitting the building. But if you actually go through, we've gone through 500 eyewitness reports that were collated by the New York Times. The reports are all over the place. Let me go to some physical features, though, Jerry, that'll fascinate your audience, which is the mode of destruction of the Twin Towers and of Building 7, which many Americans don't even realize also was destroyed on 9/11. It was a 47-story building that only collapsed at 5:20 in the afternoon, about 7 hours after the North and the South Tower. The North and the South Tower are being destroyed by some top-down form of destruction. It's all the floors remain stationary, waiting their turn to be blown to kingdom come, in the memorable phrase of Morgan Reynolds, a former Assistant Secretary of the Treasury, Chief Economist of the Department of Labor under Bush, who's become a foremost critic of the administration in relation to 9/11. They're turned into very fine dust. It all happens in about 10 seconds apiece. This is absolutely astonishing, Jerry. These two buildings, 110-story buildings, which are very sophisticated in their construction, they're a tube within a tube design. They're probably the two best engineered buildings ever designed by the hand of man, are nevertheless destroyed in approximately 10 seconds apiece. If you were to drop a billiard ball from the top of one of those buildings, it would take about 10 seconds for it to hit the ground if there was nothing between the billiard ball and the ground. And yet these buildings, which had all these floors, I mean, in the case of the South Tower, the plane allegedly hit at the 80th floor, in the North Tower, the 96th. Well, everything below the 96th floor in the North Tower and the 80th floor of the South Tower was stone-cold steel. Would anyone imagine in their wildest dreams that if a plane hit the top of the Eiffel Tower and set off a fireball that the Eiffel Tower would collapse? Absolutely not. And yet in their engineering and design, given their massive carrying capacity, which is greater at the bottom and tapered off toward the top, those buildings should have remained standing. There's no reason whatsoever why they should have been destroyed. Here's something else I'll add about the Twin Towers most people don't know. William Rodriguez, who was a senior custodian in the...
Yeah, North. I know William Rodriguez. I've seen his presentation in person, and I've had a chance to visit with him.
Yeah, reported a massive explosion in the sub-basement prior to any reverberations from what was presumably a plane hitting the building. We had two members of scholars, Gordon Ross and Craig Furlong, undertook a very minute investigation and discovered, based upon seismic data from a laboratory maintained by Columbia University and based upon radar data from the FAA, that the impacts with the planes on the building, real or imaginary, took place 14 to 17 seconds after these explosions, which occurred in both buildings. Now, I was, you know, very interested to learn when Willie came here to Madison and we had a talk afterwards, how he reported that those sub-basements filled up with water. And then it occurred to me, obviously, they had to destroy the water system, otherwise it would have extinguished these very modest fires that were occurring on the higher floors, and they would have had no excuse for the building to come down. In fact, I'm convinced that the reason that the South Tower was destroyed when it was is because a fire chief was up at that floor and said they had a couple of modest fires and they ought to be able to put it out with a couple of lines, and they were starting to run those lines up to the firemen, when I think it was obvious to the conspirators that once you extinguish the fire, there's just no reason at all for the buildings to come down, and that's when they pulled it. But the fascinating thing about the North and South Tower, they turned it into millions of cubic yards of very fine dust, Jerry. I had a first responder, Father Frank Morales, an Episcopal priest, who was among the first on the scene, who told me twice on radio shows where I interviewed him, that those buildings were actually destroyed below ground level. Now, those were each 500,000-ton buildings. Jerry, think about it. What in the world could cause two 500,000-ton buildings to turn into millions of cubic yards of very fine dust? It's absolutely stunning. And yet it appears that was an essential part of the plan, because the buildings were erected not just on bedrock, but in relation to a foundation that was a kind of dike intended to keep Hudson River water out. The dike is often referred to as the bathtub. If those buildings had come down in any proportion of their massive weight, they would have shattered the bathtub. The Hudson River water would have flooded lower Manhattan, all the subways, the PATH train tunnels, underneath the foundation of lower Manhattan. It would have been a major disaster, far greater than what actually occurred. So it appears they used some very sophisticated technique to destroy those buildings without leaving substantial remnants that could shatter the bathtub. Just to tell you how sensitive it was, when they were taking down an eight-story building afterwards, building six, they used a crane and gently pulled the wall down because they were fearful that it might crack the bathtub if they did it in any more abrupt fashion. Now, at 5:20 in the afternoon, we had a completely different demolition of Building 7, 47-story building. Wasn't hit by any planes. Had only very, very modest fires. But it was a classic demolition from the ground up. You can see the explosive charges going off. You can see a slight crimp in the roof where they took out a major support structure to ensure it would collapse inward. All of the building came down at the same time, all 47 floors. You can see it happening. And when it's over, Jerry, and it happens at about the same rate of free fall in about 6.5 seconds, you had a stack there of something like 5 to 7 floors of pancakes. Well, that's what happens when you have a classic controlled demolition. But with the North and South Tower, there weren't any pancakes, even though the NIST would claim that the buildings were destroyed by a pancake collapse. It didn't happen.
Larry Silverstein, a real estate magnate of some note. In fact, he and his father started there in Brooklyn and promoted that business up to a huge fortune. And then they just took over the Twin Towers and that whole port complex. Not too many months before 9/11 happened.
Yeah, that's right. Larry Silverstein did an interview where he reported talking to what he called the fire commander in relation to Building 7. And he said, well, there's been so much death and destruction, perhaps the best thing to do is to pull it. He said, they made the decision to pull, and we watched the building come down. Now, bear in mind that pull it is a construction term for a controlled demolition, and you could not have had a controlled demolition of Building 7 unless it was previously prepared for precisely that eventuality. So here you have Larry Silverstein actually admitting that he gave the instruction to have Building 7 pulled. And the question I have is, how can destroying another skyscraper, this time 47 stories, that was suffering from only very modest fires and hadn't been hit by any airplanes at all, minimize death and destruction? You're only contributing to it.
Here's what Silverstein actually said on TV. On a PBS special...
I remember getting a call from the fire department commander telling me that they were not sure they were going to be able to contain the fire. And I said, you know, we've had such terrible loss of life. Maybe the smartest thing to do is pull it. And they made that decision to pull, and then we watched the building collapse.
Well, we don't have to take Silverstein's word for it. We have some eyewitnesses. Here's an excerpt from a radio newscast, live from the grounds right after Building 7 went down. Listen carefully.
Edmonds reporter Eileen LaBomber. Eileen.
All right, Ralph, I'm here on Hudson Street. As you've been hearing, that 7th World Trade Center just collapsed about 5 minutes ago. Suddenly we saw officers, all tons and tons of maybe 100 officers, police officers, running north, running along Hudson Street, telling people to move, get out of the way. Then you look again, the smoke was billowing north, and people were running. I'm here with an emergency worker. He's a first-year NYU medical student. He was down there. He was trying to help people. His name is Daryl.
Yeah, so I was just standing there, we were watching the building actually because it was on fire. The bottom floors of the building were on fire, and we heard this sound that sounded like a clap of thunder. Turned around, we were shocked to see that the building was it looked like there was a shock wave ripping through the building, and the windows all busted out, and it was horrifying. And then about a second later, the bottom floor caved out, and the building followed after that, and we saw the building crash down all the way to the ground. you know, we were in shock. And then the worst part about it, we saw the smoke and the plumes of smoke coming after us, and we had to run north, actually, on that street. We just ran north and to escape from the smoke, and luckily we weren't hurt, but it was certainly very, very scary. That was about it.
This happened, about 5:17, something like that? I saw a report that the building fire alarm system had been put on test that morning, somewhere around 6:47. So it was disabled all day.
And then there was the Securities Exchange Commission, which lost, you know, investigative data for a huge variety with potentially, you know, billions and billions in penalties. All the Enron data was stored there. The CIA had an office there, the FBI too. I mean, it's just staggering what was going on here. I think that the country was being fleeced and scammed in more ways than one on 9/11.
So, Jim, what can we make of all this? I mean, is it possible there was video actually manipulated?
As my guess, about 10 or 15 people who've been doing research into this, and the fellow who I consider to have been the best, his name is Ace Baker, determined that actually all the feeds had emanated out of Fox television, and then they were sent to the different networks, and then Fox abolished its original archive, being the source from which these originated, and instead drew back from the other networks, so it would look as though Fox had simply gathered what the other networks had broadcast. But that appears to be an illusion and deliberate deception. So I think that Fox was crucial to this whole operation.
You know, they have these video pools, all the networks and the television stations, they all get together and pool their videos, so everybody gets a shot at something that they can use on the air.
Well, Ace has done the most work on this and has tried repeatedly to obtain copies of the original broadcast footage, and no one is willing to share it with him. You'd think that their attitude would be quite the opposite, that they'd be very eager to share and get this out so that anyone could study it who wanted to figure out what actually happened. I mean, you know, look how absurd it was when Bush said, you know, that they discourage any investigation of 9/11.
It'd be an interesting experiment to find out, if we could, where they got the video. I mean, there must be somebody from some control room listening to us. Maybe somebody can call us.
Yeah, well, I sure like to believe that, but remember how they've been systematically weeding out the investigative journalists who...
Well, the Fox station in New York City had a traffic helicopter, I think, right around there during the time of the event, right?
Channel 5, Fox 5, yeah. Actually, Ace Baker did an analysis of that where he... discover that if you stabilize, you get the wrong kind of reaction in the video. I mean, he has been able to prove that that was a compositing effect, too. That was one of his first studies, actually. So this guy's done very good work. I'm also in planning to include his massive study.
And we have a video link to Ace's analysis. It's interesting.
So there's such tight connections now between the corporations that own the media And the administration, Jerry. I think they feel they've got a lock, you know, that's very easy to suggest that they're going to be blackballed or precluded, not just, say, from government contracts, from government sources in relation to the news they print. So I think that there's become a symbiotic relationship that's grossly unhealthy for the welfare of the nation.
I still haven't given up on trying to figure out who was in the control room at these different stations and networks when all this happened. You know, with the cutbacks that they're having now, a lot of these guys might have lost their jobs. Maybe they'll come forward and talk to us. Hey, if you're listening and you know something about this original video and what happened in the control room that day, if you were there, contact me, jerry@jerrypippin.com, or call me. I'm in the telephone book, 918-682-2630.
Let me add, by the way, that Ace Baker, after I published the first book, I organized a conference in Madison here in August of 2007, and created a 14-hour-long DVD, which includes presentations by, for example, Dr. Judy Wood, who's a former mechanical engineer from Clemson University.
There is a laboratory under a government contract down on Long Island, not far from there that has a contract to work on particle beam research, I know.
Well, I think Judy is the one who's paid the closest attention to the diversity of weird effects that took place. There's all kinds of strange stuff going on there, Jerry. There are Building 8, for example, had the center of it removed, and it's completely gone, and yet otherwise it looks really semi-intact. Building 5 has all kinds of circular holes in it. In fact, there are about 50 circular holes in and around the World Trade Center. Building 4, half of it's there, half of it's missing. Building 3, which is the Marriott Hotel, has a huge gash in it as though a Paul Bunyan took an enormous axe and took a whack at it. You got about 1,500 so-called toasted cars that have these very strange effects with melted engine blocks, and yet the rest of the car can be intact, and some of these were quite a distance from ground zero. Here's something else that's quite stunning. It turns out that whatever it was that did this destruction of the World Trade Center didn't seem to like paper. So that you tend to assume, you know, a fire or great heat is going to burn up all the paper, but there are like, hundreds of thousands and maybe a million tons of paper scattered throughout the city. It's very strange. So you have this huge dust cloud that envelops the whole city, you know, and gradually moves out to sea. Very, very odd. Something else, Jerry, we've discovered, for example, some people have said, well, an engine was found at the corner of Church and Murray. Well, there was an engine found at Church and Murray, except it's not an engine from a 767. It's an engine that appears to be from a 737. Not only that, but Jack White discovered in Fox footage, interestingly, a vehicle pulls up and two guys wearing FBI suits and a couple others are taking something that looks to be an extremely heavy object out and appear to be leaving it there on the corner. And while this thing is supposed to have sailed down at great velocity and hit the concrete is undamaged completely, Jerry. This is fabricated. It's even under an awning. So they were planting evidence.
Jim, to pull this thing off, it would take a few people. I mean, 100, 1,000?
Quite a few people knew about it, Jerry. I'm embarrassed to say quite a few people had to know about this. See, the problem I discovered with JFK is the FBI played a role of covering things up. It wasn't trying to solve the crime. When I investigated the death of Paul Wellstone, I discovered the NTSB was covering it up, wasn't even trying to solve the crime. In fact, these plane crashes are amazing. It turns out the NTSB has the policy, Jerry, that unless the Attorney General declares a crash scene to be a probable crime scene, they can't investigate it as a crime.
Really?
Yes. So that, in this case, John Ashcroft declined to declare it a crime scene. They only investigated accident-compatible alternatives, such as the weather, the pilots, or the plane. Well, it was none of those. I mean, the idea that they claimed the pilots just lost track of their airspeed and their altitude and their direction because they were flying in on the wrong azimuth and came in 2 miles south. But if you just assign the probability of 1 in 100 to one pilot losing track of his airspeed or one pilot losing track of his altitude or one pilot losing track of his direction, that's already 1 in 1,000,000, Jerry, and there were 2 of the pilots. I mean, the improbability of the official count is fantastic, and the plane was equipped with a loud stall warning device. Get this, Jerry. The NTSB took pilots down to a simulator in Florida that wasn't exactly an Air King with a slightly weaker engine, programmed with a flight plan and weather conditions that the Wellstone plane encountered, had the pilots fly at abnormally slow speeds and couldn't get the plane to crash.
What happened with you and Ace and that fake suicide story, I mean, on your radio program? Can you tell the audience about it?
This is really strange, Jerry. I've had this guy on my show many times. He's actually my favorite guest. I much have featured him.
I mean, you two guys have done some good work on 9/11, and you seem to be friends.
Well, I thought so, too. I mean, I'd even said on one or more occasions that sometimes I had the feeling that he and I were the only two who were really trying to figure out what happened on 9/11. No, I meant that figuratively rather than literally, but sometimes the field, you know, investigating 9/11 is so fractured. There's so much contention. People are at each other's throats. Sometimes you get that feeling. So Ace came on my show, let's see, on the 6th of January. He said he wanted to interview me for a change. Well, I thought that sounded like a great way to start the year off on this new show, so on a new network. So toward the end of the second hour, about two-thirds of the way through the second hour, he started to act despondent, said how his 9/11 research had taken away from his children, how he wanted to apologize to his wife for neglecting her too, how he missed his parents, both of whom are deceased. And I was telling him, Ace, I said, we need you. I said, the world needs you. And he said, I want to join my parents. And then I heard a muffled gunshot. Silence. I was stunned. I said on the air, I certainly hope.
Now, he was on the phone?
Yeah, it was on a phone.
Okay.
And I it may have been Skype, actually. It was Skype. And I said, I certainly hope this isn't real. I wound up calling the house right there on the phone to notify his wife that she should check on him because something untoward may have happened. When I got off the air, I called the California Highway Patrol. They switched me to the LAPD. The investigating officer called me as he was approaching the house. Half an hour later, one of his colleagues called me to tell me that he had not killed himself. The next day I called expecting I might hear he was hospitalized and talked to his wife. Instead, Ace picked up the phone and criticized me for not questioning a particular controversial person that he and I have both been suspicious of on the air and hung up on me. So I knew there was something wrong here, that this had been a stunt, and he subsequently posted on his blog, where you can read it now at acemaker.blogspot.com, where he claimed this was performance art and justified because he'd solved 9/11 and no one was paying attention to him, and I deserved it because I hadn't done enough to...
Yeah, I have an email here from Ace. He says that he had given up on the scientific proof. Nobody was paying attention, so he wanted to try a different tact to get attention, creativity and art.
Jerry, this is very embarrassing. I think this is peculiar to Ace. I don't think anybody got to him, but I think the guy is somehow a tormented soul. I think he's got serious problems, and that he should do this to me was an acute form of betrayal because I'd been his strongest supporter and advocate.
So you do a radio show every week, right? Or did you change networks or something?
Well, get this, Jerry, you're going to love this. So I had nothing to do with this, but the network, which is a new network, it's WFUradio.com, was so nervous about it that they suspended me. They took me off my show. So I'm in the process of trying to put together a new one. And, Jerry, I have 3 weeks...
Let's get back to the subject at hand, 9/11. Who did it?
Pretty much an in-house, an inside deal.
No, I want you to name some names. People who did it.
Some of the principals in 9/11 appear to have been Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Donald Fife, Richard Pearl, General Richard Myers, Larry Silverstein, who had taken a control of the World Trade Center for the first time in private hands.
Silverstein, he made out like a bandit. Pardon the comparison.
He did. Just 6 weeks before, he insured it for $3.5 billion against terrorist attack, then claimed double indemnity because there were two planes. Get this, Jerry, he also switched the security firm that had been looking after the Twin Towers, the World Trade Center, since its inception, and put in another outfit that was loaded with Bush cronies. In fact, Neil Bush was a former member of the board of directors, and the chief executive officer was a Wirt Walker III. You may forget what W stands for.
No, I know what W stands for.
This
Walker.
This was a Bush cousin who was the chief executive officer right up to the day of the 9/11.
Jim, don't you have a new book coming out on this subject? When will that be out? When will it be released?
Well, that's a good question. Right now, the publisher who wants to publish it hasn't set a date yet. There's a problem with publishing in general, Jerry, which is that they're having so much competition from the electronic media that fewer books sell. Publishers have to be more restrictive. They have to give priority to the books they're going to sell well. This book won't be out for at least a year, possibly two, but there is one out there now, which is entitled The 9/11 Controversy. That gives a really quite excellent introduction. I brought together about 11 experts on different aspects of the case. And you'll find some wonderful studies there by people like the David Ray Griffin has a chapter there. Jack White has a photo analysis there. He's done a lot of work on JFK, but also on 9/11. Elias Davidson has a chapter in there. There's a Canadian scholar by the name of John McMurtry who's got a wonderful long chapter showing how all this fits into the neoconservative scheme for creating an American empire. there's a lot of good stuff in there. So I'd encourage anyone who wants to go somewhere to consider that as an option.
One of the criticisms we always get when we do these shows is, well, you're in that business, you're doing this for money and a ratings or attention. You have some DVDs out, some books. You making a lot of money off of this?
This has got me about 10 grand in debt doing all these things, like having the conference and producing these. So when I'm accused of you know, being some kind of agent, I say, well, look, if you can tell me some way to make money out of this, I'd like to know. Send me the check.
Well, now, Jim, we have a new administration in Washington, and they promised change. However, I doubt that we'll get another 9/11 commission.
Unless,
that would be too good to hope
the
for.
The Obama administration is open to some new investigation, which may have to be international, Jerry. I mean, it's like with JFK. It's really been left up to individual citizens, like the research group I organized, including the best qualified persons to ever study the case, a world authority on the human brain, who was also an expert on wound ballistics, PhD in physics, who was also board certified in radiation oncology, and an expert on x-rays, a legendary photoanalyst, one of the physicians who attended the dying JFK, and then 2 days later, his alleged assassin, another PhD with a specialty in electromagnetism. We've really taken the case apart to separate the authentic from the inauthentic evidence and reconstruct it from the bottom up. And when you do that, Jerry, it becomes very clear what happened. For example, we discovered 15 indications of Secret Service complicity in setting the man up for the hit. That we're doing our absolute best to get this out to the American people. And I might mention, Jerry, that, you know, that DVD is available. It's called The Science and Politics of 9/11. You can get 14 hours for $20. I mean, it's a great investment. And there's a wonderful presentation of Ace Baker, who analyzes the Fox 5 video.
Well, I think we can agree, Jim, once you appoint a commission, it looks like Cover Up City. I mean, look at the 9/11 commission. Wow. What a whitewash.
But the Bush approach was completely absurd. And then, of course, when they finally do convene it, they try to get Henry Kissinger. They wind up with Philip Zelikow. Bush and Cheney don't want to testify. Finally, they come in only if they can come in together, holding hands, as it were, not testify under oath. I think that notes may have been allowed to be taken, but no recording. I mean, it's all ridiculous. They're acting like a mafia goon, you know, a hoodlum, a mob chieftain, who doesn't want to be interrogated and caught up on some perjury rap, you know. He wants to get away with his crime free and clear. That's been the Bush attitude toward all of this.
Our time is up, Jim. We'll do another 9/11 show soon. James H. Fetzer has been our guest. And he, of course, is the organizer, one of the co-chairs of Scholars for 911Truth.org.
Well, that's great, and I'm really glad to be on the show with you, Jerry. And I like your background, and I like your sense of the situation in relation to the media, because I think you're absolutely right, and that's a major part of the problem.
Our web producer has been Jane Swartley. Until next time, thanks for listening. Good night. Cheers.